Yep, yep.
Recording.
Okay. Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Smith, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is April 26, 2023, and we have two matters on our oral calendar before us this morning. Marshall, will you call the first case?
Our first case is A221736, Jane Doe, appellant versus Special School District Number 6, et al. Respondents, ABC School District et al. Defendants.
I believe you are familiar with our rules, but just to go over things, each of you will have 15 minutes for your oral argument. And I do want to say at the outset that I understand that this, we may have more questions and you may have a little more to tell us in this case, given that we had a precedential decision come out, you know, after respondents filed their brief, and just a couple of days before the reply brief from appellant. So we will be I will be checking with my panel mates and you, and we'll, if we need to take a little extra time, we'll do that. So, but generally, we're going to try and have each of you have 15 minutes for your oral, for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have additional time for 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note that the podium can go up or down, if that helps, and that there's a timer on it, which will help you keep track of time. Please introduce yourself when you begin your arguments, because we're recording these arguments and we'll post them on our website. And that way, all those people who want to listen to your arguments will be able to know who you are and who you represent. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Counsel, my name is Paul Peterson, and it is my honor to represent the appellant, Jane Doe, in this matter. This matter, as the court is aware, is on appeal from a grant of summary judgment at the district court level in Dakota County District Court, Judge Knudsen presiding. And as the court referenced, there's been some related appellate work, not only with respect to these issues in general, but also with respect to the facts of this case in this particular school district. But as noted at page 3 of respondent's brief, this case is much different than the one that you recently weighed in on with respect to the other South St. Paul plaintiff. So let's get to those facts and talk about what happened in this setting. My client, as a second grader, became acquainted with a teacher in her elementary school, now known as Babbitt, beginning in second grade, the appellant alleges that a special relationship developed between Babbitt, an employee of the district, and a teacher in there under contract with them in various roles, and my client. That relationship began.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm afraid that we'll run out of. We're so familiar with the facts, and I think even unless you would disagree, I mean, the district court, I'm sure you disagree with perhaps the framing of some of it, but the district court lays out, sort of grade by grade. You're welcome, obviously, to incorporate what you need to answer these questions, but if I can try to put these facts in the context of our legal questions, let's talk about vicarious liability, applying the common law standard as Sterry says, right? But also like looking at in a framework of the test that's laid out. What in this case would make, what are the facts that would get you to trial on whether they were lawful, the teacher in this case was performing lawfully assigned duties and particularly around the time of the assault, but tell me your response to that. What would be, what are they? When the school district, I think, argues this was not part of any sort of approved programming.
And thank you for that question. And as I was starting into the facts, I was sort of anticipating I might not spend much time there, and that's, I think that's appropriate. So with respect to vicarious liability, the key factors, and they're embodied both in the deposition testimony, but also in the expert analysis that was laid out in the various expert disclosures, which included a deposition of one of the two experts, and the court is aware of the procedural issues that we ran into quite apart from the case with the health of Dr. Arati. But on the questions, the disputed questions of fact that a jury would have to deal with, no matter what the claim, but especially on the issue of vicarious liability, is you look at what is the office or what is the employment. And if we're looking at the common law standard, the key to the common law standard, in my mind, is the fact that we are looking at a situation where the employment is the genesis for the assaultive or tortious behavior. And all along the way, we have educators who are charged with supervising this teacher, all right? But this is, goes to direct supervision, negligent supervision, but also goes to vicarious liability. They are supervising him in such a fashion that he is violating rule after rule after rule, and they are not, they're either not aware of it or they're not calling him out on it. And the testimony, so let's look at why these rules are in place. You say, well, none of them really relate to the sexual assault, all right? And there's a tendency in our minds to organize it and say, the actual physical act of the sexual assault is so horrible, we're going to put this in its own category over here. And that's okay. I think we all recognize that. The problem is, if you decide to treat that as a totally isolated incident and a tort in and of itself, and ignore all the expert testimony and all the facts surrounding how the employment relationship allowed this perpetrator to do his bidding.
But Mr. Peterson, if I can just stop you there, I mean, isn't it, I mean, shouldn't we be focusing on the sexual assault, I mean, for the vicarious liability claim that occurred in the classroom? And, you know, and then the question, you know, are there enough disputed facts about that to get to the jury? As, and that the way I see a lot of the expert testimony is then when it comes to, I mean, that establishes the scope of employment. If you get past that, like as in Sterry, then you go to the vicarious liability question, which looks at the scope of employment plus foreseeability in that special way, and that's what those experts go to. I mean, when we're looking at the vicarious liability claim, isn't that the right way to think about it?
Yes and no. And yes, in the sense of we have to recognize that that is a horrible outcome at the end, but no in the fact that the experts are telling us that this relationship and this abuse starts much earlier than the physical act.
If I may, though, the grooming, which, I mean, I just say, speaking for myself, not to the panel, I mean, the facts in this case are horrific. We all have to acknowledge that. But wouldn't it be to say that the grooming is either part of the sexual assault or an independent tort, wouldn't that be kind of new ground in Minnesota law, as opposed to looking at that those facts, to sit, for an example, to say, in the negligent sense, was this foreseeable? I just ask because we're an intermediate court, and, you know, we're hesitant to be establishing that.
Yeah, and I'd like to approach it this way, if you'll bear with me on an analogy. I've done a lot of product liability work. And when I've done product liability work, I am presenting evidence as to the standards that manufacturer has to meet. And everybody, when I lay them out, a lot of times you kind of recoil and you go, well, that sounds like an impossible standard. That sounds really difficult. I don't know that it's fair to hold them to that standard. And then you realize it's the expert engineers that are testifying that that is the standard. There's no legislator or judge who is saying that in that product liability case, who is saying the manufacturer had to meet some legal standard. It can come up, but most of the time they're saying, based on the industry standards, based upon the science of engineering, these steps should have been taken and they weren't.
If I could take us back to the scope of employment issue, because I think the expert part of it might be more relevant on foreseeability, on vicarious liability, but on the scope of employment piece, it's my understanding that the acts themselves, the tort itself, has to be within the scope of employment. And so the question then sort of becomes, how do we characterize or describe this type of tort? So is there some authority that would look at sexual assault or some other, something similar, and broaden out the act that is the tort to include establishment of the relationship years earlier as part of the tort.
The science, and this is where I'm getting into the engineering analogy, the scientists who are the experts are telling us, and this is how this goes in the law. If you look at how we're writing about these cases, and I present that to a scientist on the issue of abuse and sexual predatory behavior, they look at this and say, what century are these people from? The idea that
right,
we are...
some authority, and I think this is getting to Judge Jessen's question, if there isn't any authority that describes a tort such that we look at, you know, this context of the relationship over a long period of time and not just on this act that we are, it's easier to focus on that act, right?
Yeah.
Is there some authority that tells us that's how we do it? And if not, can we, as an intermediate court, in the first instance, decide that or characterize a tort that way? It's sort of creating a claim.
It's not creating a claim when we follow the evidence. That's the key, is that the experts are providing vicarious liability insights because they're telling us a number of things about the nature of the abuse from a scientific standpoint. The scientists, the experts, and that's why, so the question is, my main question is, why are we here now making these kinds of decisions and discussions? We have a jury instruction on vicarious liability. So the question is, factually, has there been enough developed to say to a jury, when you consider these facts, you have to consider the nexus between the employment relationship and the harm, the wrongdoing. And the jury can decide what is the wrongdoing. Our experts who are on record say the wrongdoing begins when we get this special relationship commenced. And they're not saying you can't have a good, close mentoring relationship between teacher and student. What they say is, the problem is that this relationship begins and there's a lack of oversight. So let me take one example of a factual question that in and of itself I think gets us to the jury. There is evidence that Babbitt was putting, during the school day, while my client was an elementary student, was transporting the student on and off campus and was using a private doorway to do it, violating rules on entrance and egress, violating rules on student transportation. And I asked the principals who were involved and the administration involved, were you aware of it? No, we weren't aware of it. And the defense tries to wear that as a badge and say, we weren't aware of it. And our experts and our evidence is, why weren't you aware of it? This is a major problem. And the transportation, there are multiple reasons why the transportation rule exists. The primary one is to protect the teacher. If you are alone with a student, you don't have any witnesses to what happened. The student could make any allegation under the sun, and this teacher's in a vulnerable position. The reason for entrance and egress has to do from everything from gun safety to safety of students. And so the experts in this case are telling us, I'm sorry, I don't mean to.
No.
The experts are telling us the way to go, and the problem with the law, and I don't blame the law, we always are behind. We're always following. But for decades, they've been developing the science of how these people operate, and school districts should be aware of it, and they should be training. Because the Babbitts of the world don't wear a big sign saying, I am a sexual predator and I'm choosing this child today.
So with respect to, this speaks more to me to the negligence arguments, or claims that the school district should have done more. Like, they didn't supervise. They should have known the violations that were occurring. Right. And I guess my question about that is, I mean, you're referencing policy violations. So, in other words, the school had set up policies that presumably should preclude, you know what I mean, you come in through one door, you do, you know, all of these policies that that you're saying were violated. And in a negligent supervision case, I mean, I appreciate your argument, like you can't just say, oh, I'm willfully blind or I'm recklessly blind, so therefore I didn't know, but I get off because I didn't know. But what do you need to show that? I mean, if there are policies that the district truly did not know the violations of, does this plaintiff just get to say, well, you should have? you just should have? I mean, because that basically there that seems inconsistent with, and I appreciate, you know, you're saying a law should evolve with, like, you know, the scientific understanding of grooming or whatever, but it seems inconsistent with the negligent supervision cases that exist, that if you don't have any reason to know, district, that there's been a violation of your policies, you haven't negligently supervised that employee.
If there's evidence of...
You don't know the violations.
Policy violations, and someone is in charge of supervising, the person is violating the policy, I think it is a jury question whether or not that constitutes negligence.
So without any evidence that they should have known...
Our experts say they should have known.
So it's the experts who are saying they should have known. By looking at this case, they should have known that the student was being let in a side door? Why?
Because,
why should you know that? Why should they know that?
Because in this day and age of school safety, and even in the day and age we were at the time this whole case unfolded, there are multiple reasons why you want to make sure you are securing the building. And that's
I understand the reason for the policy. I'm saying, why should they know? I mean, if there was no one posted at that door, for example, is it that, oh, they should have had someone posted at side doors, or they should have had someone watching camera? I'm trying to figure out why they should know that violations have been occurring when they have policies that are properly meant to stop security violations.
And that's really fair, because I'm scratching my head trying to figure out how they didn't know.
And why?
Well, because if you've got a student, if you're supervising your campus and you're looking into this and you see a student and a teacher drive off in the teacher's car, and if they're properly trained.
That's what I mean. You say, if they see, how do we know anyone saw it?
The point is, our experts are saying, look, if you properly train people and you enforce your policies, then a janitor who sees this should be encouraged to report this to the administration. They have camera systems. They have the ability to move around the physical building and observe what's going on. And he didn't do this just on one occasion. This was year after year, day after day. Babbitt is exhibiting grooming activity. And yes, it is in the early stages. But if you're trained on grooming and you know what to look for and you understand these policies serve multiple purposes, and we have our expert who says, Dr. Knauss, who says one other reason why these types of things are important is that the predators operate in darkness. They operate with a lack of supervision. But if they start getting caught, if the light of day is being shined on their activities and people are asking questions, they move to someplace else. They don't stay in that target environment.
So may I just interrupt here? And Marshall, can we add 5 minutes to each party's time this morning? We'll just add 5 minutes to yours, Mr. Peterson, and to you. If you all finish early, there's no problem. Judge Smith, did you have a follow-up?
No.
Let me ask, with regard to the negligence-based claims, what are the factual differences, and I think you've alluded to some of it, between this case and the case of Doe 598, the non-presidential opinion we just issued?
Yes. There are a number of them. I'll try to list them all. There's the transportation.
Just give us the highlights.
There's the transportation issue. There's the ingress-egress out the private door issue. There is the fact that my client, and remember, the defendant is the district, the whole district. And the district, it's a matter of record that when my client was a student of the district in the middle school, they were referring her for truancy, so she was identified as truant in the middle school, where down the block, this same student who's truant is in the district building in Babbitt's class. And so you ask yourself, just that fact alone, that this district, in its supervision of these students and taking its job seriously, doesn't even know that a student they are reporting truant is in one of its buildings just down the street with one of its teachers. And our experts look at that, the school expert and the expert on sexual predatory behaviors, and they look at that and they say, how in the world is that possible? How is it possible that they are reporting a student to the authorities as truant and she's in their building? She's in one of their buildings. They have no idea. And that is a problem. If you are running things in a negligent manner, then harm occurs. They were running this school and district in a negligent manner. But again, you don't have to decide that. All you have to decide is, do we have enough facts to get to a jury? So let's look at some of those additional facts. There's much more of the lunch and meals that are occurring in the room. My client, when she is back, is actually sexually assaulted on school grounds. And we're entitled to every inference. I noted in the other decision, in the related case that I am distinguishing, one thing was there was mention of, well, we aren't really sure what this volunteer program consisted of. I've been asking questions. I'm not sure what it all consisted of, and I think that's because the district wasn't sure what it all consisted of. And you had a middle school and a high school, and they're sending students down. Sometimes they're signing in. Sometimes they're not. We get the inference that this was school-related activity on that, the fact that there's not a more clear picture of what did that exactly entail. But my client was brought back supposedly to volunteer at the same time this district was reporting her as truant. And so there are many other examples. It would be the pervasiveness of this relationship. This relationship was much more involved, both from a time standpoint and from a visibility standpoint in that elementary school. And we have testimony of one of the people in the administrative office saying, hey, what's with this person being here? And the principal saying, it's okay, I've approved it.
So you're distinguishing some important facts. I'm also curious, you know, there's a discussion in Doe 598 about the Columbia Heights case. And the emphasis there, the quotation there from Columbia Heights is, there was no dispute that the employee engaged in sexual misconduct for his own personal reasons, not on behalf of the school district, in performance of duties or tasks lawfully assigned by competent authority. So it seems like you're asking us to analyze Columbia Heights very differently than we did in Doe 598, and to say, instead of focusing on this conduct was for his personal reasons, to have a much more broad view. Is that true? And if so, are you asking us then to, in a sense, overrule Columbia Heights?
I think Starry did that on this issue.
Doe 598 didn't think Starry did that.
And it was the key to Doe 598, or I consider the Columbia Heights case. So, and I wrote the amicus brief on that for one of the parties appearing. And so I'm familiar with that case. The big difference between that case and our case, it's hard to tell from the decision making, but it is that there was a lack of expert testimony in that case. There is expert testimony in this case. So we are distinguishable from Columbia Heights right there. But I would suggest that what Columbia Heights did, which Starry, I think, corrected, and I don't know how, people smarter than me can decide how they coexist, but the Starry said that we have to apply the common law test, and the common law test made a marked, direct, express change back in the mid-70s to 80s, where they said we are no longer going to look. What Doe 598 says to me is they're looking at the old common law test. And where Doe 598 went wrong is they failed to apply the common law test. Starry tells us we're supposed to apply the common law test, which has been our position all along. And so from that standpoint,
I think, just for clarification, when you're referring to Doe 598, I think you're really talking about Columbia Heights.
Columbia Heights.
Yeah, Doe 598 is the more recent
Thank you for correcting that.
Right.
I'm sorry, Doe 598. I messed up the question.
There's a discussion in Doe 598 of Columbia Heights.
Yes.
And it sounds like you disagree with the way Columbia Heights is characterized in our recent 598 opinion. And my question was, are you asking us to put aside that characterization from our recent non-precedential opinion and interpret things differently so that we're not focused anymore on whether this misconduct was for his own personal reasons?
Yeah. The way I would reconcile that is I would say to the extent that that quote or that discussion in Doe 598, to the extent that that is talking about common law making the immunity match the common law, all right? The common law made a change, and that discussion in 598 reflects the older common law of analysis where you look at it from the standpoint of what is the employee's desires, and as opposed, see, I'm out of time, I apologize.
Questions? Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. We will have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Vieira, and joining me at council table is Abigail Kelzer, and we represent the South St. Paul School District. I do agree with Judge Jessen that the allegations in this series of cases are horrific, but the district is ultimately not responsible for them. The two people that were responsible are the individuals. So I do want to intend to start with Steery, unless the court wants to direct me otherwise.
I think that was Ms. Vieira would have been our first questions, just to give you the opportunity to tell us how Steery impacts this case from your perspective.
With all due respect, just because this is my first opportunity to respond, I do want to preserve the argument that the district disagrees with the decision in Steery based on the statutory interpretation arguments that were laid out in our brief and in the Attorney General's petition for review. But I'm not going to try to change your minds just a few weeks later. So, and I think that Steery actually supports the district's position in this case, because when you apply those three factors, none of them are true in this context in the way that they were in Steery. So the first one that the court looked at is whether the employee is acting as a representative or agent of his employer. And there's a helpful footnote in Steery, it's footnote 6. And there, the court distinguishes between the corrections officer and the coach in the Columbia Heights case. So in Steery, the corrections officer was in the course of supervising the plaintiff. She had the authority to search his person. She had the authority to direct him into this closet or supply room. And she had the authority to issue him discipline. In contrast, the coach in Doe 175 did not coach the plaintiff or supervise her in any capacity. With respect to the time frame in which appellant was sexually assaulted, this situation sits much more squarely with the coach, who had no formal role, than the corrections officer, whose role was to supervise the inmate. And I know that appellant took the position that they are entitled to a presumption that it was a school-based volunteer program. But they're only entitled to the benefit of reasonable presumptions. In the request for admissions, appellant admitted that she was not enrolled at the school at the time the sexual assault took place, and she was not receiving credit for volunteering in Babbitt's classroom. So she is in a position something more like an invitee than a student, because her parents had not sent her to that school. They actually sent her to a completely different school that's not affiliated with the district.
So let's speak about that, because I think that this volunteer program situation affects a number of these factors, probably the lawfully assigned duties as well. So, I mean, as I read the record, it seems like the district brought up the sort of the four credit programs. It seemed clear, at least from the declarations, that those existed in seventh and eighth grade. I'm not sure. It was unclear to me from the record whether there's any record evidence about. I'm not sure what it says about high school. I don't know about those high school programs. It was unclear to me that the district put in anything that we have authorized high school programs. So that I have one question around that. It was also unclear to me whether that's the only way in which a student may volunteer. And all of that, I think, is meaningful when we get to, this is all about reading the record in light most favorable to the plaintiff at this stage, when there's deposition testimony from the secretary in the office that she spoke with the principal who authorized Babbitt to be, excuse me, Doe, to be there, and the secretary's testimony that she understood that Doe was in Babbitt's classroom. So it seems to me like the district is suggesting, I'm not sure what the district is suggesting, that that's the only way in which a teacher may supervise a volunteer in their classroom is through these authorized programs, or that this school district had no idea that the student wasn't in the authorized program, which seems to be a factual question given, you know, how the, so help me with that, because if teachers can authorize, can supervise volunteers in their classroom, you know, in different ways, apart from these four credit programs that are in seventh and eighth grade at least, why isn't that a duty of a teacher?
So to address the question about the authorized volunteer program and the middle school or high school, the district has a combined middle school, high school, secondary program. So
a combined middle school, high school?
Yes. So the students in the actual authorized volunteer program where they get service hours or credit for volunteering in the elementary school, that's a high school course that they are enrolled in. This student was not enrolled in that class.
I'm sorry. I must be confused. I thought that the declarations were, I thought that the district was the elementary in 7th and 8th grade and that the high school was out of district.
She did not attend high school in the district.
Right.
So, okay. So the district has one secondary school that's 712.
Yes. Okay.
She attended 7-8 and then attended a different high school after that.
Okay. So there was no program with that different. There's no evidence that there was a program with her high school to volunteer at the elementary school. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So we have a high school student coming to volunteer, being signed in, evidence read most favorably that the principal okayed it. The people knew her, I presume knew that she wasn't in a district high school.
I don't think that's a fair presumption.
Okay.
Because, and this gets to some of the, well, how did they not know where she was when she was truant? Is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, says that education officials have the right to access educational records when they have a need to know that information. So the elementary secretary has no need to know whether this student is enrolled in this high school or another high school. Similarly, that's why, you know, there's this assertion, well, you know, why didn't they just talk to each other and figure out that's where she was? Because there was no reason for them to talk to each other because they didn't, the high school didn't know she was at the elementary school and the elementary school didn't know she was supposed to be at the high school.
So back to the question of if there's evidence that the principal told the secretary it is okay for this 10th grader, 9th and 10th grader to be in the school, specifically this Doe, why does it matter what authorized programs there are?
So
relative to that teacher's duty.
Yeah. I don't think that's a fair reading of the transcript. I believe the secretary said the other secretary told her that the principal said it's okay. But then when you look at the principal's transcript, he says he didn't even know who this specific student was, but he said it was okay for kids to volunteer in the classrooms.
Well, I'm looking at page 49 of McClellan's testimony where she said, I just asked because I knew they were older, and she's referring to Doe and another student. I said, why are they coming today or something, or do I see them a lot or whatever? And so then I went into the principal also, and I asked him, and he said, no, they're helping the kids. So, and then did Vanessa have a conversation with you as well? Yes, and it sounds like you were questioning frequency in which Doe was volunteering. She says, yes, blah, blah, blah. It raised a question, and Vanessa also said that. And then it says, and then what was the explanation the principal gave you directly when you talked to him? That he, in that case referring to Doe, was upstairs helping students with their assignments or whatever. Did the principal mention anything about Mr. Babbitt in that conversation? No. So there, Doe was mentioned. And I mean, and again, we're at a summary judgment stage.
Mm-hmm. So, and sorry, I was misremembering that Vanessa conversation as the secondary part there. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, I don't think the transcript is clear that the principal specifically said Jane Doe can be in that classroom because when you ask him, he says, I didn't even know who she was. So it doesn't, he could not have said this person is allowed to be in the classroom without knowing who that person is.
Is that a jury issue though? I mean, you're challenging the credibility, I think, of this or understanding of this statement. And why is this something to be decided on summary judgment?
Well, I think in addition to that specific statement, then we also have the request for admissions that she was not an authorized, or that she was not enrolled in the school in 9th and 10th grade. She was not enrolled in a credit-bearing class. And when you look at both principals' depositions, how they describe the volunteer programs, it is the volunteer programs that are assigned from the high school. And it may they may not have been the most organized programs. I think that one of the principals admits that. But that doesn't change the fact, that doesn't make her somehow a district student that is entitled to be in the district for that purpose.
Can I ask a question now about, you know, if we agree that this is more like an invitee, mm-hmm. it's still an invitee into a school. And presumably you would agree that the school or the school district has authority over who it permits to enter the school.
Yes, and I think that's true, but even if the district permitted her to be there, that doesn't change the analysis around the remaining stare factors, as well as that doesn't create a special relationship because, the case law specifically says in Gilbertson v. Leininger that, the invitee or a house guest of somebody isn't in a special relationship versus the type of relationship that a school district would have with its own students. But if I can just jump back to the first stare factor, and I think Judge Bryant hit on this as well, that there is the language quoted from the Columbia Heights case in the Doe 598 case is that there's no dispute that the employee engaged in sexual misconduct for his own personal reasons. And I think that is equally true here. Even when you look at the experts, none of the experts say that Babbitt had a sexual relationship with a student on behalf of the district. So then turning to the second prong of that.
But Stare, I mean, even when we look at 598, when 598 does the analysis, yes, it quotes that, but then it goes into what are the facts here that talk about whether there's a supervisory position. I think Stare makes quite clear, obviously, it's not going to be within anyone's job duties to sexually assault someone. And what Stare is talking about is, do your job duties effectively give you access and authority over someone? And so I think that's, if a student can come in, invitee or in a program, sign in, be known to be going into a teacher's classroom, it just seems like just logical that a school who permits someone to come in didn't just permit them to come in and go run free in a classroom, that there's an understanding that the classroom that they're going to will be supervised by a teacher.
So I think that gets to actually the third stare prong of the performing lawfully assigned duties or tasks. And there is no evidence in the record that the school district assigned Babbitt the role of supervising volunteers in his classroom. You've got the testimony from both of his supervisors. You've also got the interrogatory responses that say here were his roles. He was a teacher. And then it describes the duties of a teacher.
I understand that, but you also have this testimony that the principal or vice principal knew that that Doe was going into his class to assist him. Why doesn't that create a disputed fact?
And the court addressed a similar issue on page 9 of Doe 598 when it pointed out that Doe fails to identify any duties or tasks that Babbitt was subject to regarding classroom volunteers. There is no assignment of a duty or task from the administrator to Babbitt. And the administrators, all of the people who are identified in interrogatory as Babbitt's supervisors, they were deposed and none of them said, yes, I assigned him to supervise volunteers. Sorry, did you have a question?
No. So if I could go back on this, I just want to make sure your argument is clear, because I agree with Judge Smith that it's hard to imagine that anybody's lawfully assigned task would include molesting a child. So you're not arguing that the statement from Doe 175 that says, for his own personal reasons, not on behalf of the school district, the reasons or the motive for engaging in sexual misconduct somehow survives that part of Stare that says lawfully assigned and the performance of duties lawfully assigned, right? You're not arguing the contrary, as Judge Smith said, nobody would. You're not that person, right?
No, and I think Judge Jessen and I had that discussion last time, too. We're not saying that there are circumstances in which somebody would be lawfully assigned to sexually abuse someone, but the question here is what duties was he performing at the time of the sexual assault?
Well, I think the question's slightly more precise. It's, is there an issue of fact regarding what he was assigned to do? And maybe it's assigned to do when it comes to invitees in the classroom, authorized to be in the building, who are then in his classroom. What lawfully assigned tasks might he have? Is there a question of fact about that?
And
that, to me, seems to be the more, because of the nature or the posture of this case.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair characterization of the question, but I don't think there is any evidence in this record that that was an assigned duty or task. When you look at the other evidence that...
So there's no evidence in the record that he has any assigned tasks or duties regarding someone in his classroom that's not a student?
No, because the interrogatory answers explain he was a teacher, this is what he was employed as, and here were his job duties. None of the job duties include supervising volunteers.
Again, I'm not saying supervising mm-hmm. volunteers. I know you're going back to that because that was sort of the focus of so mm-hmm. much of the discovery, but I'm saying anybody in the classroom who's not a student, is there anything in the record to suggest a teacher has some assigned task over that person?
No, I think that it's, I don't have the exact text of it here, but the supervision referred to in the interrogatory answers is to oversee students as they work in his classroom. And from a, from the district's perspective, it also just wouldn't make sense to assign a teacher supervisory responsibility over a non-student.
No, I mean, you could say people can't come into your classroom and be disruptive. People, you have an assigned responsibility to make sure non-students don't disrupt students or don't, commit acts of vandalism or, whatever it might be in the classroom. I could understand there being some general expectations or tasks assigned regarding what you can permit non-students to do in your class.
Yep, and that is in the visitor policy, which I looked, and I don't think it came in this record, but it's referenced in DOE 598, that there is a visitor policy that says, visitors aren't allowed to disrupt classrooms, they aren't allowed to, take students off on their own, things like that. But there's no responsibilities, and DOE 598 makes this finding, there's no responsibility in that policy for a teacher to enforce that policy.
If I may, mm-hmm. Judge, I don't want...
No, please.
If you don't have follow-up. Looking at the continuum of cases that we've done recently, looking at Sterry, looking at Doe 598, because I'm not saying that Sterry overruled the Columbia Heights case, but it changed the landscape. That's why it's a presidential case, right? So it seems to me, speaking just for myself, we have a continuum here. And you've got Sterry on one end where, she's supervising them. It's at the motion dismiss stage. Mm-hmm. They're right there. They're on the premises. Okay, we've got that. We've got Doe 598. But here we've got something, it seems like a lot more facts in Doe 598. We've got, and I'm sure I won't get them all. One, it's all closer in time. Obviously, the assault takes place in the classroom. She's in the district up in middle school when she's going and visiting his classroom. She tells one of her teachers, as I understand it, in middle school that she's going to visit Babbitt's classroom, who's a district employee. That's what I'm going to give you a chance, but I'm just trying to go through some of this. Is there something about a vice principal speaking to her class about boundaries at one point? Anyway, it just seems like there are more facts here, and that's why I just struggle with where we are on that continuum. And if I'm struggling with where we are on that continuum, shouldn't this go to the jury? So help me with that.
So with respect to the facts, there is no evidence she told the vice principal that she was going to Babbitt's classroom during the day.
Not the vice principal. I thought she told her a therapist and her teacher and a teacher.
Was a therapist and her truancy officer. Her therapist, as the record shows, is not an employee of the school, was actually not authorized to share information with the school about the private conversations during their therapy sessions, which were paid for by private health insurance. The truancy officer is, by statute, an employee of Dakota County and not a school district employee. So there's no evidence that anyone who worked in the district knew that that's where she was going. But, with respect to the continuum, I respect it's that a, this...
Just to pause, there's evidence that people who worked in the district knew she was going there because the office staff knew she was going there.
Yeah, but they didn't know that she was supposed to be at the high school at the time.
Right, okay, I just yes, wanted yes, to clarify yes. that. Mm-hmm.
But she was also going there when she was in middle school in truant, right?
Yes, but that's where she did not tell anybody in middle school that she was going to There.
I didn't mean interrupt. Want to interrupt you, counsel, sorry.
So, and I do respect that, you know, on the continuum, this is closer to Sterry than the other cases, but the distinction between this and Sterry is that we've been through discovery. We have depositions from the administrators. We have the interrogatories from the school district that say, here are their job duties. And the administrators described the volunteer program, and none of it involved supervising students who are not district students. So the fact that we have those undisputed facts in this record is the reason that it doesn't have to go to a jury, because there is no evidence in this record that somebody with supervisory authority over Babbitt told him that he should supervise volunteers. And that's the big distinction between, I think, Sterry and where we are in this case.
So I see your time's running now. May I ask one more question?
Of course.
Because you're focusing on the volunteer program, I'm curious, do you think that the complaint is so limited, or that the interrogatories were limited to this volunteer program? That's the only basis for which there could have been assigned tasks, or is it broader than that?
The question in the interrogatories was to describe Babbitt's job duties. It had nothing to do specifically with the volunteer program. So I think that was much broader than the volunteer question. I don't recall the extent to which the complaint limited it to any sort of volunteer, but I think that interrogatory would be broad enough to encompass that duty if it existed.
Okay, thanks. Can I ask one follow-up question? So how does it not get you to a jury then? This is the problem, I think, my struggle with the volunteer program and what it means. If there's evidence from the school secretary that the principal said Doe can be here in 10th grade, mm-hmm. I think 10th grade, and was upstairs and says he was upstairs helping students with their assignments or whatever. Why? And you're saying there was no one, or at least Babbitt, and mm-hmm. presumably no one else, who was charged with supervising this student, and yet the principal authorized, again, giving the best record. Why doesn't it really hurt you on the negligence cases then?
So
claims.
In the deposition of Connie Garling Squire, she was the principal before the principal at the time of the incident. She explains that with the volunteer programs, the supervisors are actually the high school instructors that have assigned the students to come over. So I don't think that, you know, the existence of a student in a classroom is the same as assigning the teacher a job duty to oversee that volunteer.
So even the teachers, so no teacher has responsibility for the students who come, whether they're in a program or not. Is that what you're saying?
So the
it's the sending school that has responsibility for those students?
So I believe her testimony was that at least with respect to some of the volunteer programs, that was the case, that the sending school had supervisory authority. I don't know that the follow-up question was asked about the remaining students. But even from a, you know, school management perspective, the teachers at the high school would be the ones that are entering grades, determining credit, things like that for the participation at the elementary school.
Okay. I'm good. Thanks.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In my rebuttal, I'd like to kind of finish the answer that time did not allow with Judge Bryan, but also it is closely aligned with your continuum question. So I'd like to address that. So the Sterry, and I found the quote you were talking about, Judge Bryan. So how do we work through these three cases? So Sterry, I think, suggests that the one truism we all know is that obviously the actual commission of a sexual assault is for personal reasons. To the Sterry, to the extent that that is coming in to being weighing in on the test, if that's being used to weigh in on the test for vicarious liability, I think Columbia Heights has been overruled. So then the question is, in Doe 598, you distinguished it factually. And I would distinguish this factually from Doe 598. And it is much more closely aligned with Sterry. And it's more closely aligned with Starry because we have an ongoing relationship and that's much more pervasive. And that's important because one of the questions was why should they know? How is it they're supposed to inform themselves as administrators? Well, if you've got one plaintiff who's only occasionally seeing this teacher versus somebody who's in every day, is a student in the actual classroom when some of the behavior occurs. And so this is a very pervasive relationship.
Again, when you say some of the behavior in the classroom, I think in your opening argument, we focused more on the grooming behavior that was you were arguing as part of the tortious acts.
Yeah.
But I just want to make sure I understand. Are you still tying it to the grooming behavior? Or when you say that now, are you being more specific, like an actual act of sexual abuse in the classroom?
Well, I think, and this is where we have to follow the science. The science says...
Well, I mean, I'm just saying in terms of distinguishing this from 598, presumably there was some additional grooming behavior in 598 that might have occurred in the school. So to the extent that that didn't make a difference in 598, maybe it sounded like you were going to focus now on the distinguishing fact of an actual... potential act of abuse in the school, which is different from 598.
Well, and that did occur. And just to be clear, that occurred after my client was a student of the district, but while the client was passed into the school building with the permission of the principal. So there's actual sexual assault. My client is assaulted one time, and there's a second attempted assault that is thwarted because another teacher knocks on
but
the door.
Getting back to the comparison with 598... are you saying that on its facts this is different because something about the grooming conduct is different than the grooming conduct in 598? Or are you saying that it's different because you have an act of abuse on school property that you didn't have in 598?
Yes, both. It's all the above. We have much more pervasive grooming activity occurring. It's occurring in the classroom. And that's why, when we talk about a continuum, what it said is, that's really what our experts on the plaintiff side are saying, or on the appellant side. They're saying there's a continuum here. And if we think about it, the sexual abuse is less of a physical act and more of an abuse of the mind of a child and the psyche of a child. The grooming behavior, actually, the creation of the trust, a lot of the reasons why students have so much trouble down the road once they've been abused is they end up with their adolescence and their normal child development is disrupted. And it's a concept known as delayed adolescence. They now hit adulthood. They're in their real-world situations, and they got no basis for it because they have not considered themselves a child developing. And now they got trouble. And that's where, when we talk about continuum, I think the jury, as the voice of the community, needs to weigh in and tell us where that continuum is. And they might agree. They might say, hey, the grooming separate from the sexual act, we don't buy this. And I don't know the record in 598 like I do ours.
Well, in terms of trying to figure out what is the tortious act, it seems like the court does have a role, this court, the Supreme Court, in sort of defining or delineating what that might be. And to the extent that grooming behavior is overlaps with innocent, supportive, positive interactions, there might be a problem with us allowing the jury to decide that behavior itself is part of a tortious act, right?
If we look, I would challenge that to the extent of, I think that's approaching it with looking at it as what happens once the cows are out of the barn. All right, and what we're talking about is what does a school district have to do to make sure that the barn door doesn't get opened up?
Right, and listen to the experts, I think, is your...
And that leads us to a factual conclusion, which leads us to the procedural posture. And on the summary judgment standard, we should prevail here. This is a case that a jury needs to hear. And let's say I went through the trial... And I see my time is up. May I just briefly conclude? If we were up here and I'd tried the case, and if I had won the case, there's evidence to support that jury's verdict, and that's the test. And if I lost the case in that kind of posture, I would not have good grounds to try to disturb because of the conflict of evidence. There's a jury question here, and we need to hear how that turns out.
The court thanks both counsel for excellent and helpful arguments in this challenging case. Thank you.